Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the endarkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the endarkened corridors of power, and we shine a light ahead of us to where evolution, we hope, is leading. Purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems instead of defending positions. There's a concept in Jewish theology called Tikkun Olam, roughly translated as the healing of the world. According to the 16th century rabbi Isaac Luria, in order to set the world right, humans must be involved in this repair of the world. In our own times, this call for restoring wholeness has been taken up by this week's Wiki Politiki guest, Rabbi Michael Lerner, who is the founder of Tikkun Magazine and of Beit Tikkun Synagogue in Berkeley, California. Rabbi Lerner is the author of several groundbreaking books, including The Politics of Meaning, Restoring Hope and Possibility in an Age of Cynicism, which caught the attention of Bill and Hillary Clinton, incidentally, who invited him to stay at the White House. We'll talk a bit about that. 10 years later, he wrote The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right, a book I found very helpful in pointing out that by focusing primarily on economic issues, progressives were left dealing with the spiritual malaise that so many people in this country had experienced, left that right to the religious right. In 2005, Rabbi Lerner became chairman of the Network of Spiritual Progressives, whose mission was to, quote, challenge the materialism and selfishness in American society and promote an ethos of love, generosity, and awe and wonder at the grandeur of the universe. So here we are. I'm so happy that we have you. Your latest book, Rabbi Lerner's latest book, is called Revolutionary Love, A Political Manifesto to Heal and Transform the World, where he lays out the vision of a caring society where we evolve past the narcissistic memes of capitalist dogma and self-deceptive self-help teachings. Rabbi Lerner's unique perspective comes not just from his spiritual and political foundations, but also from his background as a psychotherapist. So welcome, Rabbi Lerner.
Glad to be with you.
Good, good. Well, we'll jump right in. Your new book is called Revolutionary Love. What is revolutionary love?
Well, you know, most time when people talk about love, they conjure up the sweet, gooey stuff that sometimes goes on in the first 2 years of somebody's relationship with somebody else. That love then seems to fade a little bit, but not for everybody, but for most people it fades somewhat over the course of the years. Revolutionary love is not only about that kind of love. It includes that, but the kind of love we're talking about is the kind of love that was exhibited when people, after the destruction of the Twin Towers in 2001, literally thousands of people came down to that site while it was burning, and trying to help to save the people who were caught in those two buildings. The foundation of their going there was their caring, really loving other human beings without knowing them. So revolutionary love is the love that the Torah, my favorite book, the Torah commands of Jews. You know, there's one time in the Torah that says, love your neighbor as yourself. But there are 37 times when, in one form or other, the Torah is commanding us to love the other, the stranger, the one that you don't know. In other words, that we have an obligation and to care for and love all the human race. And that means the people we don't know as well as the people we do know. And that creates a different kind of consciousness. It's a consciousness that says, not only am I my brother's keeper, I'm also responsible for the well-being of everybody else. Now, obviously, that's overwhelming. It's at one level. But another level, that's what politics should be about. Politics should be about the way we manifest our caring about people that we don't personally know.
So that's revolutionary love. And I mean, that's certainly a context, you know, coming from the biological standpoint. My book that I wrote with Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution, we talk about recognizing that biology is saying that the next phase of human evolution is seeing that we're all cells in the same body. So we begin to recognize some of the ways we treat one another as autoimmune dysfunction. So it turns out that biology is actually confirming what our spiritual teachings have been telling us for millennia. And I think the evolutionary, the crisis opportunity that we face right now, I think we really have to begin to take this seriously. So why did you write this book now? Why revolutionary love right now at this moment? Is there a possibility for this now?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the reason for it is because I believe that the I've been a progressive social change activist since 1964. Okay, that's quite a bit of my life. And I've been involved in the social change movements, and I still support them. But what I have noticed is that the social change movements are often shooting themselves in the foot in a variety of ways because they don't manifest love and caring. They have objective programs, okay? I call it objective caring. Objective caring is what the New Deal did and what now the left wing of the Democratic Party, the good guys, the ones that I supported, of course, for when, you know, Bernie Sanders and AOC and lots of other good people. But the left wing of the Democratic Party is still stuck in a largely materialist worldview. It says if you can deliver material goods to people who have been deprived, that's what politics should be about. Now, I'm all for that. Anything I say from now on in this conversation, please understand that I support the liberal and progressive agenda and its agenda of trying to alleviate some of the worst suffering that is caused by the selfishness that is embedded in the capitalist marketplace. But that goes only so far. It's what I call objective caring. It's delivering goodies, economic goodies or human rights, economic entitlements and political rights. They're very, very important. They're a central love orientation that you have to do that. But simultaneously, what they did not do was recognize the human beings another set of needs. And those needs are caring needs, a need for love, for caring, for connection, and for a sense of higher meaning and purpose to life. Those are the needs that the right has been able to take up because the liberal and progressive forces don't even address them.
Yeah, you in your book, The Left Hand of God, that's where I found so much very, very valuable insight that, you know, talked about how essentially the secular progressives had conceded this spiritual domain to the religious right, and they were the only ones who were talking about the spiritual meaning beyond simply the economic goodies. And people have wondered, you know, why do these voters these working class and rural voters, why do they seem to be voting against their own economic interests by voting for by voting their religious conscience instead? You've been talking about this for a while.
Yes, and I can every poll taken of middle-income working-class people indicates that they agree with the programs, overwhelmingly agree with the programs of the liberal and progressive world, but they don't vote for them. And the reason they don't vote for them is because they've experienced, when they've ever gone to or connected to a liberal progressive world, whenever they have encountered it, they've often experienced an elitism, a disdain for the life, the culture and life that they live, and in particular, the disdain for anything spiritual or religious. And I can tell you that with that previous book, when I went around the country talking about it, I remember one scene that was so that was representative of what lots of people were telling me. It was the story of this woman who got up after my talk and said, "I want to tell you what happened to me just this week. There was this guy that I was really interested in, and I had hoped that he might call me and ask me out. And finally, earlier in the week, he did call me and said, would you like to go for breakfast with me on Sunday morning?" She said, "I'd love to go out with you, but I can't do it Sunday morning. Sunday morning I go to church. Any other time I can." He said back, "Church? I thought you were a liberal." And he hung up.
Okay.
That message that that somehow if you are interested in a spiritual dimension to life, if you are interested in some kind of religion, and I'm not saying what kinds of religion or whatever, I'm just saying if you have any such interest, you're immediately pigeonholed by people in the liberal and progressive world as either not adequately developed psychologically or else just plain reactionary, a hater, somebody who's a racist or a sexist or a homophobe or a xenophobe, or else just plain stupid. Well, that message has been communicated in a zillion different ways, and it's not just in the last 4 years. This has been building over the course of the past 50 years in this culture. And so many of the people who are good-hearted, liberal and progressive, they want people to not starve to death. They want to save the environment. They want to do a lot of good things that I totally support. And you'll see in the book, Revolutionary Love, I propose specific ways to do that, which are not less radical, but even more radical than the liberal and progressive agenda. But what they don't do is project a sense of caring about other people. And this is not just outside to outsiders, because if you have ever gone to a meeting of political progressives, you find that very often, unless it is tightly controlled from the top, like Bernie's campaign was, and that was a good thing that he didn't get into this. But so many of the progressive meetings, and so many of progressive demonstrations, there is no love there. There is righteous indignation, which is I totally support. But people don't even take care of each other. The activists in the movement, when you get together with them, they're all putting down each other. They love to argue. Well, I love to argue too, but
it's genetic. It's genetic, Michael. It's genetic. I know.
Okay, genetic. Okay, but it is also, but I don't only want it. I started to try to convince people, you know, in your meetings, take the last half hour of the meeting and have it be dedicated to people getting to know each other, making friendships, making caring, and explicitly saying, this is because we are a movement that cares about caring. We care about caring. We want people in our movement to already embody the vision of the world we want. Now, in the book, I lay out a vision of a caring society, but you can't get there unless we ourselves embody that caring in our movements. And you almost never see it. Even Bernie never stopped at the Bernie Sanders never stopped the rally and said, "Okay, let's take 10 minutes. Turn to people you don't know here. Introduce yourself." And see if there are people that you might want to get to know later after the rally. Right. In other words, but if you go to a church, if you go to a right-wing church, you go in there and they will embrace you before you're even in there. They love you. They care about you. You know, like I said this, and this is not just for Christians, because in the Jewish world, I can tell you, I have my own synagogue now, so I don't go to other places. But in the years when I didn't have a synagogue that had Saturday morning Torah study and services, I'd go to different places. If I went to a reform or a conservative place, I'd listen. Great, the prayers were somewhat uninspiring, but then a great progressive message would come from the pulpit. The rabbi would give a, and then afterwards nobody talked to me. I'd go home. Okay. Now, when I went to an Orthodox synagogue, the message was reactionary. There was great energy in the prayers, but there was, the message from the rabbi was usually extreme right wing in a variety of ways. Afterwards, before I got a chance to leave, people would come up to me and say, "You're new here, aren't you? Do you have a place for lunch today? Do you have a place for lunch? If not, I'd like to invite you to my house. Or is there anybody in your family who is sick and needs a visit? We have a committee that goes to visit the poor. The sick." Is there anybody in your family who is sick or would like to have somebody to talk to or whatever? We have that committee. We'll send somebody there. We'd love to show some caring. And by the way, this is when I was younger. Are you single? Because if you're single, we can introduce you to some women in our community that you might find interesting.
I mean, we're going to have to take a short break. Rabbi Michael Lerner will be back after this message and talk more about revolutionary love. Steve Behrman, Wiki Politiki here.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
These are the sounds of a dinner. A dinner that almost didn't happen. A dinner now served, thanks to people like you. Due to COVID-19, 17 million more Americans may face hunger. Feeding America is helping our neighbors in need. And if you're able, you can too. Donations are being accepted at feedingamerica.org/coronavirus. Brought to you by the Ad Council and Feeding America. 200 food banks strong.
Okay, we're back with Rabbi Michael Lerner. You know, what you were saying about how you were embraced by these in these Orthodox communities. I grew up in a very non-religious family. We lived not too far from a very nice big synagogue where I had my bar mitzvah. In fact, Rabbi Schenck was head of the New York Board of Rabbis. He gave the eulogy for John F. Kennedy. He was a Jewish theologian, the Jewish minister who gave the eulogy at the funeral. When my grandfather died, and my dad, again, was not religious, he decided that he was going to go to shul every Saturday and say Kaddish. But instead of going to this fancy-schmancy one, he went to the most out-of-the-way, little hole-in-the-wall Orthodox shul on Eastern Parkway. We had no idea what they were saying. And I said, Dad, why are you going there? He says, look, I don't know if God exists, but if he's anywhere, he's there and not at this other place. So it was that sense, at least in my family, that there was something fundamentally moral about life that could or couldn't be expressed by religion, but we all knew what it was. And so I'm curious, in terms of your upbringing, my joke would be you were probably a blue diaper baby. That is, you grew up in a family of Democrats, but somehow you seem to have combined politics, religion, and psychology. And I think probably all three of those have helped you, get to the perspective that you've had now for 25 years since you published the Politics of Meaning. How did you grow up, and what role did religion play in your own family life?
Well, my family was primarily a political family, and they had one area of commitment to some value that wasn't popular, and that was their Zionism. Zionism in the 1930s and 40s. Was not the mainstream Jewish community. Many Jews said, no, you shouldn't talk that way because you'll be accused of having dual loyalties and so forth. We shouldn't do that. But after the Holocaust, that moved very much in a different direction. The Jewish community adopted Zionism and became deeply committed to it. So my parents were, as I was growing up, were very much involved in the Zionist movement and threw that into American politics. And I got to see American politics from a very inside perspective. My mother became the administrative assistant to the U.S. Senator from New Jersey, which is where I was growing up, the first Democrat to be elected a senator for maybe 100 years there in New Jersey. And I got to see it very closely, and my father also became a judge. And what I saw was a lot of corruption. I saw not so much after money, but after trying to play up to the interests of the people who have money, which you needed in order to get reelected or so. And so around the age of 12, I had the experience of going to a camp, a religious camp called Camp Ramah. And in that people were very much into religion in a whole different way than in the huge synagogue that my parents belonged to, where there was the cantor was somebody who sang for the Met the rest of the week, the Metropolitan Opera. But on Saturday, he was a performer, and the whole thing was a performance. After that, my parents took me to a weekend that synagogue had, and they had invited Abraham Joshua Heschel, who was the most significant Jewish theologian of United States Jewish theologian in the 20th century. And I heard him and I got very moved by it. And so I started to read his book that was God in Search of Man, it was called. And so by 13 years old, I was reading every Saturday. I would take my Sabbath observance to sit and read a chapter of his book. And the first, the first year I was doing that, it was very above my head. At least the first third of the book was above my head. I didn't understand some of it, but some of it somehow intuitively it resonated with me. And the other two thirds were fantastic. Anyway, I went back to Camp Ramah and was sitting there on a Saturday afternoon reading his book. And lo and behold, I didn't know that it was going to happen, that he was even there. Heschel was visiting that weekend at the camp, and he saw me sitting there, and he said, he stopped and said, could you tell me who you are? I've never met anybody, 13, who's been reading my books. It's usually too hard for people. People a lot older than that. And so we had a conversation. And he said, come visit me at the seminary. Well, I had already been thinking that maybe seeing how screwed up American politics was, but not knowing, I'd never heard of a left. I didn't hear about the left for another 10 years after that. But my way of acknowledging what was wrong in this world was to get into Judaism. I announced to my parents that I wanted to become a rabbi. They were furious. They thought this was the worst possible thing that could happen to a Jewish boy. They had been trying, particularly my mother, they were trying to ascend the ladder of the class ladder. They wanted, and my mother said, "Look, we now can guarantee you law school and come back here after you graduate college, if you get into a good college, and then come back here after you finish law school, we can hand you the Democratic nomination for Congress in this area, and you'll win." Okay. I said, but no, I don't want to be a congressperson. I want to be a rabbi. It took them another 8 or so years before they could accept that. However, I got into it. Judaism was my rebellion. Okay. And but it turned out that I had a long rebellious tradition to get into, because Judaism was not what the pablums that were offered at the big synagogues of the Reform and Conservative movement. Judaism was a call to transform the world. And the prophets were those people whose criticism was not about non-Jews or whatever. It was about the way Judaism was being done. So Judaism Judaism became a critique of Judaism. So you understand what I'm saying? That the way that people were doing Judaism all along was always missing the boat, and they were but they honored the prophetic tradition, and the prophetic tradition was always kicking sand in their eyes and saying, "Look, you've got it wrong. The only thing that counts is, are you ending poverty? Are you ending oppression?" The great prophet Isaiah, living about 600 years before the Common Era, so that's about 2700 years ago, stood in front of the temple in Jerusalem on Yom Kippur and yelled at people as they went in, "God doesn't want you to just pray. If your prayers are, here's what God says, your prayers are an obscenity as far as I'm concerned." That is Isaiah quoting God. God says this, it's an obscenity that, your prayers will get you nowhere. when you pray like this, but then you don't treat your workers with great respect, when you don't end poverty and oppression, when you don't loosen the bonds of all who are oppressed. This is what, and Judaism even picked that up and reads it. That's the reading from the prophets on Yom Kippur, so the highest, most important day of the Jewish religious year. Now, people today go into synagogues, but there's nobody standing outside. They have this read, this portion is read, still read in almost every synagogue on Yom Kippur. And people shrug their shoulders and say, oh, isn't it nice that we had this nice little prophet long ago? But I took up the prophetic tradition and wanted to make it real, as did Heschel. And so that became my direction. And that childhood experience had a huge impact in the direction of my life.
You know, it's really interesting that, you have this essentially looking at the essence of the religion rather than the practice and the details. I really appreciated, it's been 25 years almost since you published The Politics of Meaning. And that was a book which Bill and Hillary Clinton apparently picked up on. What was it in that book that captured the Clintons' imagination? And tell us more about that, because I think that was really you came up with a very unique idea at that time in the 90s. This is right after the fall of the Berlin Wall and this seeming like there was really potential for breakthrough. Tell us a little bit about the theme of that book and, what caused
the... I should say that the media turned me into somebody who had real impact on the Clintons. I think that was a huge error. They called me the guru of the Clinton White House. The Washington Post did a full page article about that, saying that I had basically taken over poor Hillary's mind. The New York Times, wrote a five page article in its Sunday magazine, saying essentially it was called This Year's Prophet, and that was me, supposedly. But actually, it went like this. Hillary was somebody who had a similar kind of religious experience as a teenager and was into that. But then she married somebody who was very good-looking, very charismatic, but didn't have those values at all. And when she got into the White House, when he got elected, I was a psychologist before I started Tikkun magazine. And the reason I got into psychology was in order to study the psychodynamics of American politics and try to understand why people were moving to the right. And what I learned in my studies there, and the studies, I mean, I was the principal investigator of a National Institute for Mental Health research project funded by NIMH to study the psychodynamics of working class people in America. And what I learned when we focused on why were people moving to the right was that a lot of them felt that the left didn't understand who they were, that the left was willing to deliver what we call material goodies and political rights. That is, I call it objective caring in the form of that. And many people love it and still deeply appreciated the New Deal and appreciated to the extent that the New Deal has been carried on in subsequent generations. They've really appreciated that. But they had more than material needs. They had that, yes, they wanted their economic and political needs to be met, but people also had a sense of hunger for meaning and purpose in life that transcended the selfishness and materialism of the capitalist marketplace. Now, they didn't know where to go, and the one place that was open to them were the mostly the churches. I mean, these were people who came in, most Americans come from a Christian background. So the churches had had something very strong to offer that the left didn't offer. The left bought into the notion of that the capitalist marketplace conditions almost everybody into, and that is the notion that you're living in a meritocracy, and where you end up is a function of your merit. If you were smart enough and you worked hard enough, you could be part of the top 10% of the population that owns 85% of the wealth of the society. But the truth of the matter is that that's not true. That no matter how hard you work, that the vast majority of working people never get a chance to move up the economic ladder, at least very, very little. There's very little in the way of mobility between where you where your parents were. Now, the pie as a whole has expanded so people get more material goods, but the relative distribution of wealth in this society remains the same. A small percentage of population owning vastly disproportionate amount of the wealth of a society. But if you're in a working class and you've got a job that is really lousy, really frustrating all day long, and you're working so that to make enough money for the people who own those institutions or control the institutions, people come home feeling terrible about it. So we interviewed them. Okay, they tell us the story, and we'd say, well, why are you feeling terrible? And they say, well, I have nobody to blame but myself. You know, we live in a meritocracy. It's my fault. That message got massively reinforced by pop spirituality and pop psychology, because both of them continually taught to people, you can create your own reality. Whereas the truth is, most people cannot create their own reality. They're stuck in an economic and political system that is already preordained to keep the vast differences in wealth and power as they are. Within that, you can move a little bit, but very little. So now they come to the left, and this left says, we want you to be with us. But basically, if you have any religious or spiritual inclinations, you're probably on a lower level of psychological development than we are. And if you hang out, we want you to hang out with us because maybe you'll evolve into a higher being by hanging out with us. You'll get rid of all that religious crap and you'll be like us. But in the meantime, we want your votes and we want you to support our movement. Well, that message increasingly over the course of the past 50 years has sunk into people, so more and more people feel alienated from that left. Now, Hillary in the early 90s was still had a part of her. She had been a Methodist as a teenager. She had been an activist in the Methodist youth organizations. And so she still had a part of her like that. And so her first talk that she gave as president, well, actually, I should back up for 4 years.
I'm going to have to interrupt. Michael, I got to interrupt you. We're going to take a little break. Hold that thought. We're going to talk about it when we get back from our break.
Okay, sure.
Thank you, Michael Lerner. We're talking with Rabbi Lerner, Steve Behrman on Wiki Politiki.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio. IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please.
911, what is your emergency? 911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Okay, we're back with Rabbi Michael Lerner. You were talking about the early days of the Clinton administration and Hillary having these remnants of this religious enlightenment that she received when she was a teenager. Now, tell us more about that and her first talk as First Lady, you said?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it starts 4 years before when we at Tikkun magazine, that's the magazine I edit, T-I-K-K-U-N. Tikkun means healing and repairing, transforming the world. Anyway, Tikkun was already developing our politics of meaning. And we handed out material at the Democratic National Convention. And amongst the people who took it and started to read Tikkun were the Gores and the Clintons. That was in 1988. Hmm. So in 1992, I heard Bill speak, and he gave a talk that sounded almost word for word from my last editorial. So I introduced myself to him. This is at a big event, and he said, "I love your magazine." I said, "Yeah, that seems obvious." And he then began to quote for me articles in it. But anyway, after they got elected, Hillary's first major speech, in that speech, she said, "What this country needs is the politics of meaning." And then she said some of the ideas that were straight out of the stuff that I was writing. So I thought, wow, that's amazing. And I encountered her a few weeks later and at the opening of the Holocaust Center in Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. And so I introduced myself to her. She hadn't met me. And she said, what am I, your mouthpiece or what? But anyway, she then invited me to the White House. We sat and strategized about how to try to get more focus on the hunger for meaning and purpose to life that is central to what shapes a lot of people's minds. But after her speech and after that, the media started to say I was the guru of the White House. There was a huge attack on her from not only right-wing media, but from the center of the Democratic Party. They didn't want somebody to get influenced by somebody who was a known radical, a known leftist, a progressive. That was me.
Yeah.
I was somebody who wanted transformation of a society, but I didn't only want a weak version of the New Deal. I wanted to end the huge disparities of wealth and power in the society. And I wanted the Clintons to begin to develop educational programs that would focus on the need to transform ourselves from a society based on selfishness to a society based on love and caring. And that just drove people in the White House crazy. And they attacked Hillary, even in the White House. They were attacking people that were working with her, were attacking her for being under my influence. And then the second great thing is that a lot of people who were around Hillary were also influenced by AIPAC, which is the organization that blindly supports Israeli policy towards Palestinians. Mm-hmm. But Tikkun is a magazine that had been explicit in criticizing Israeli policy and that our caring has to include the caring of Palestinians, not just of Jews. So people were freaked out that I was going to influence her away from the blind support to the right wing in Israel. The result was that after a while, she had to make a decision, and she decided she'd side with the more conservative forces, and she gave up the politics of meaning entirely, even to the extent that about 2 years later in an interview, she said, he wasn't any influence of me. No, in fact, and they asked him, well, wait, isn't it true that in the first year of your presidency, the only living person you ever quoted was Rabbi Lerner? Mm-hmm. And she said, well, that may be true, but, I'm not in that anymore. And as she decided she wanted to herself become a senator and then a president, she distanced totally from that. But I had a similar experience with Barack Obama, because Barack Obama came to one of our conferences and asked to speak. That was in 1996. And we let him, sure, come on, speak. He then spent time, he was living then in Chicago, and he went to some of the meetings of our groups, of Tikkun reading groups. And so when I met with him in 2006 in his office in the Senate, and I had just published The Left Hand of God, he said to me, Michael, I agree with everything you say. I've read all your books. I love them. 2 years later, he gets elected president and essentially forgets all of that and ends up deciding in the face of the biggest economic crisis that the country has ever had at that time, since the Depression, he uses the money that has been allocated to deal with that Depression by bailing out the big corporations and the investment companies, and leaving ordinary citizens to fend for themselves. Meanwhile, millions of people are losing their homes as a result of that crisis. He does nothing about it. So, and there are a number of other things where he was seen by everybody as a great liberal, but he never acted on it. He did nothing for blacks. He didn't do a single thing that would alter the situation of blacks. He barely helped at all the Native Americans when they were putting their lives on the line to block the new pipeline. In issue after issue, he was a lukewarm progressive, very lukewarm, not really believing, not really willing to take any risks, not standing for anything very strong. So after you get a president like that, there was great disillusionment in the country. And along comes Trump, and he says, I stand for something. I'm not one of these weak people. And so lots of people gravitated to somebody who's going to stand for something, make America great again. Whatever, but that was a product of the failure of the Democratic, the center right of the Democratic Party, which controls the Democratic Party, to stand up and say, we accept that a new way of thinking, and that new way of thinking is what I present in this book, Revolutionary Love, and I also did present some of it in the last one, The Left Hand of God. It's a new way of thinking. It says we need a new bottom line. Today, every institution, every in our society gets judged efficient, rational, and productive to the extent that they maximize money or power. We want to advocate for a new bottom line that let every corporation, let our economic system, our political system, our judicial system, our education system, our healthcare system, let them all be judged efficient, rational, and productive to the extent that they maximize people's capacity to be loving and caring, kind and generous, ethically and ecologically sensitive, capable of looking at other human beings not through the narrow framework of what can you do for me, but rather seeing them as embodiments of the sacred and looking at the universe, looking at the earth itself, not from the standpoint of, is there something here I can turn into a commodity and sell and make a buck out of, but to look at it primarily from the standpoint of awe and wonder and radical amazement at the grandeur and mystery of this universe. So that's a revolutionary love. That's a whole different way of thinking. We call it, and to build that, we are trying to build a movement for love and justice, we don't want to throw away the justice part. We're not somebody who says you can do it all yourself. Change yourself and the world will be changed. No, people have been saying that for the past 50 years, and the world has been getting worse, not better. Destruction of the environment has escalated, not decreased. So changing yourself only, of course, on the other hand, of course, you need people to work on themselves also. But to not work on yourself from the standpoint of thinking that's the contribution. No, the contribution is to work simultaneously on two fronts, on developing your own inner spiritual and psychological well-being on the one hand, and on the other hand, simultaneously being part of movements that have a vision of a different kind of world, a world based on that new bottom line. I call it the caring society, caring for each other and caring for the planet, or the movement, we call it the love and justice movement. Yes, we want economic and political rights, but we also want love and caring and kindness. And sadly, the liberal and progressive forces don't embody that in the way that they are. They don't actually treat each other very nicely. There's a lot of harshness between people who are in the progressive movements and the liberal movements. They're not nice to each other.
I think that there's a certain degree of truth to that. I kind of grew up as my young adulthood in the New Left and so on, and I found out that there was one person that we met who was a worldwide expert on communal living. But unfortunately, nobody could stand to live with him, you know, so that was that was kind of the paradox. So here we are. Obviously, you put this information out. All of the political barriers, the labels like socialism, all of these labels have prevented this very universal idea. What you're talking about is very universal. It's love thy neighbor. It's endemic in every spiritual and ethical path. And yet, to get traction on it, here we are. We're at a very pivotal point in our evolution. It's do or die, really. What gives you encouragement and hope that this time something like this will be able to take hold?
Well, let me say that I'm not sure. I'm not sure that that's going to be the case. I'm saying it's still possible, but there's nothing inevitable about it. It depends on how many people can get beyond understanding the need for economic and political rights and economic justice to go and say, yes, that's one part of the picture, and the other part of the picture is building a world based on love and caring, kindness and generosity, ethical, environmental sensitivity, awe and wonder at the grandeur of the universe. You've got to have that component. Now, can that happen? Yes. Will it happen? It's not inevitable. It depends on whether the people who are listening to this show and lots of other people, people who are buying the book, Revolutionary Love, you can get it at any online bookstore.
And we have a link, by the way, on the WikiPolitiki page for your show. We have a link to your site. People can find it that way as well. And you go to Amazon or whatever.
And by the way, we also have now a podcast called Dream with Us. No, Imagine with Us. Imagine with Us. It's and it's on all the major podcast places. You can find it. Imagine with Us. We have in the Network of Spiritual Progressives a training for people on how to be a spiritual activist. We call it prophetic empathy. You can go to spiritualprogressives.org and you can learn about prophetic empathy and how to get trained in it. We're building a movement, but when you say, well, what gives me hope? What gives me hope is the knowledge that every human being actually wants a different kind of world. And so but they think it's totally unrealistic. Nobody will go there. That's what people told us all along about why they weren't fighting for what the world they really wanted. So what I want to say here is key message is don't be realistic. Because being realistic means accepting the contours of change that the people in power have told you is possible, based on their control of the media, their control, their ownership of the media, their control over the center of the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party. I mean, not to say that there aren't differences between the two. The Republican Party is overtly racist and sexist and so forth. The center of the Democratic Party would like to see some minimal change as long as it doesn't affect their pocketbooks or the pocketbooks of the people who fund them, which is the super rich. So, and the left wing of the Democratic Party has great programs, wonderful people, but they haven't yet gotten the idea that people hunger for something more. And they'll tell you, so you might hear from them as well, oh, don't, it's unrealistic to think that anybody's going to respond to a world based on love, caring, kindness, and generosity. But I tell you, don't be realistic. Spend whatever time you have left on this planet going for your highest vision of the good.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Michael Lerner. That was a great way to end. Don't be realistic. If you don't like the current reality, we can change it through revolutionary love. Thank you for being our guest today on WikiPolitiki, Rabbi Michael Lerner. We'll be back with you next week. Thank you. Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah. Very good.